Okay, now I'd like to introduce tonight's main speaker, and he is Mark S. from Tempe, Arizona.
Mark's wife's alcoholic. Hi, everybody. Came all the way from Arizona for the rain. Awesome. And we actually, my wife Marty and I drove over this morning or this afternoon and saw some snow in Pine Valley, which whenever I've done that drive, I've never ever seen snow in this close to San Diego. So that was pretty wonderful. Thanks to Terry and the committee for the invitation to share an evening with you. Terry's been talking about this meeting for months. I'm pretty excited about it. And I've had an opportunity to listen to some of the speakers, some of the men and women that have shared their experience, strength, and hope here. And it's, you know, quite a lineup. The other thing that I just want to say I appreciate is some men took some time out of their lives to meet Marty and I and take us to this amazing vegetarian restaurant not too far. It didn't seem like it was too far from here. And, you know, that kind of kindness was something that wasn't happening to me when I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I notice it. I notice it today. And so I appreciate those men and what they did. So here we are, 10,194 days today. I've been sober. Thank you, and I owe that to the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous and a God that I believe is love. And the actions were outlined very well. Nat, great job. And the actions of Alcoholics, I believe that. Alcoholics Anonymous is two things. AA is two things. AA, fellowship, and fellowship consists of meetings. It consists of the relationships that I have in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the conventions that she talked about, and it's going to workshops. It's hanging out. It's the meeting after the meeting, and it's the meeting before the meeting. And I don't poo-poo AA the fellowship. I actually stayed sober on AA the fellowship for 2 years. And it worked for me, you know, until I went stark raving sober. I mean, I just absolutely crazy. But thank God the steps were waiting for me then. But up until that point, in terms of relationships, that was really important to me. Because frankly, I didn't know, you know, we read almost like a Chinese water torture at many meetings how it works. And we talk about that, you know, that you want what we have. I honestly had no idea what you had. What I knew is I didn't want what I had anymore. My belief is that's really the only requirement to get into this deal, that you have to have a desire to stop drinking and not want to live that way anymore. And those are great motivators to get you to do most anything. At least it was for me. And the other Alcoholics Anonymous is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I sobered up in Omaha, Nebraska, we were, my original home group was the Infinity Group. It was a young people's group. And interesting that you mentioned that. And then we shifted gears and went to a men's stag and we read the big book and we worked the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. We were introduced to the 12 traditions and which essentially, you know, the steps are about me not killing me. Okay, the traditions are about us not killing each other, right? And it's about keeping this circle together. And the 12 concepts of world service is really what our purpose is. So it's about service. It's about getting out of myself. So let me tell you a little bit about what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. And I got, I grew up, I'm number five of eight kids, and grew up a Catholic guy that was in a house full of girls. I have five sisters, and I have lots of favorable memories about that and the family. One of the things that is very alive and well in my memory was the sarcasm that existed in my family. I don't know if it existed in yours, but there were times I lived my life in a defensive stance. You know, I mean, just like you couldn't say anything wrong, you'd be cut to shreds. And we did it lovingly, right? You know, we only hurt the ones we love. Why do we do that? Because they're closest to us. You know, I really am that tornado whirling through my existence, right? And I have no idea of what I'm doing and the impact that I have on the people that are around me. So I grew up in this family, and I totally idolized my dad. And I still, in some ways, I guess I do. He's just celebrated his 80th year. He's got 14 years of sobriety. And he is, he's an amazing man. And we don't do a whole lot in Nebraska. We have a little thing called Nebraska football. It hasn't been around for the last few years, but we're hoping that there's a resurrection now with Mr. Pelini coming back. But I can remember all the way back as in single digits, helping my dad make screwdrivers and just a variety of drinks that he would do. He started out by renting campers, and then it got to buses, and they'd go down to the Kansas game or the Missouri game or whatever, and he'd pick up these gallon jugs, and we'd be pouring vodka in there and pouring tomato juice. And or so I learned early on in terms of, you know, how to do that kind of stuff. And what I remember about those days is that everybody seemed to be laughing and having a good time. And we had a lot of parties at my house. And I remember just how exciting that was. And my dad just seemed bigger than life. And I wanted to be like him. I wanted to be just like my dad. So I started drinking like my dad. When I was 10, 11, 12 years old, I was out with some friends. And they got bought or stole, I cannot recall, a half a gallon of vodka. And unfortunately, we only had about a half a gallon of orange juice. So initially, the drinks were quite orange. And as the night wore on, they were getting clearer and clearer and clearer. And what I do remember of that evening, you know, it wasn't like I had pimples at age 11 or 12 or anything like that, or, you know, I got bigger than life or whatever. I just remember feeling a sense of ease. A sense of fellowship or kinship. And the other thing I remember is that I woke up in my yard and I didn't know how I got there. The other thing I remember is I couldn't wait to do it again because it seemed like it was a good time. And that was really my first drinking experience. And back then, like a lot of us, I suspect, I just drank on the weekends. And we drank before the football games, the high school football games. And, you know, go hang out with the big kids. And, you know, all my life I've wanted to be somebody other than who I am, right? And, I mean, I can remember all the way back to age 8 and swimming and always doing very well, but not feeling like a sense of fitting in. And I bought my mom, you know, got the Birchwood Club sweatshirt, and I wanted the biggest sweatshirt. You know, and I used to wear clothes that were much bigger than I was. I'm just a skinny little kid, right? And I used to like to hang around with the kids in double digits when I was 8 and 9 years old, and they would sort of let me do that. And it was like that all of my life. And as I got older, I just drank more and more and more. Seemed like the only normal thing. Nat talked about drinking scotch. My dad used to buy scotch by the case. And he used to buy good scotch. He bought pinched scotch. By the time I was 16, 17 years old, I was dragging a bottle of pinch to parties. I got to tell you, there wasn't too many guys at age 16, 17 that were dragging a $30 bottle of scotch to parties. And I liked it a certain way. I liked it, you know, I didn't like it with water. I just liked it with a little bit of ice. I mean, I liked the buzz. By 17, I already knew the different buzzes for the different booze. Okay? So what kind of night was it? It was going to be a wild turkey night. I mean, I knew what night that was going to be. Or if I want to just absolutely get raunchy, well, you know. And it just and on and on and on. So by then we were starting to smoke dope and just do whatever you know it took to get the edge off. And I used to, my sense of proportion to the planet was quite skewed in terms of my impact or how big I was or how important I was and the amount of time that it took for me to get ready for a party just to get drunk. And I used to get drunk before I went to the parties because rarely did they have enough booze. I was bringing Big Gulps to parties before Big Gulp existed. And, pay a buck or for a plastic cup made absolutely no sense to me. And so I'd have my 32-ounce cup and I was, you know, watch out, here I come. And I used to pride myself. I mean, I was about 120 is about what I weighed, maybe 5'7", 5'8", years old. And my mouth was about 100 pounds of that. And, I mean, just this. I've heard people talk about drinking and having a sense of fitting in. When I drank, it didn't matter. You know, it just didn't matter to fit in, right? It's like you were lucky to have me there. It didn't matter anymore. You know, that sense of my, you know, the hum of my existence would sort of die down a little bit. So I went from a marginal member of the in-group to owning the friggin' in-group, you know, kind of a thing. In terms of my own, in my mind. I went to a private school up in Minnesota and swam up there. And once I got up there and got away from my folks, it was essentially Katie bar the door. I got introduced to a variety of drugs that in my small circle in Omaha just didn't flat out exist. And so by the time I was a freshman, I was regularly dropping acid and doing cocaine and just whatever was available. Towards the end, I was essentially a garbage disposal. You know, the answer was, you know, are you kidding me? If you ask me, do you want any of this? Well, why are you asking me that question? Just put it in the mouth kind of thing, right? And, I mean, it just felt like that. And in my, we talk about drinking to oblivion, and that's how I drank. I drank every time to oblivion. I can remember a half a dozen times where it mattered in terms of how much I drank. It mattered because of the people that I was with, maybe a girlfriend or I was with my brother or I was somebody that was watching me. So there was an intention to maybe drink a little bit differently. But for the most part, it wasn't like that. Our book tells us in the fourth chapter that, you know, if you have a difficult time deciding whether or not you're an alcoholic, then, you know, here's a little test. I mean, here's how we define alcoholism. If you ever tried to control the amount you drank and you couldn't do it, or just flat out tried to stop drinking altogether and you couldn't do it, then you're probably an alcoholic. When I work the steps with the guys that I sponsor or just men that want to go through the steps with me, I essentially make them make a list. Concrete list. Tell me all the times that you made an agreement with yourself or with somebody else to drink. And it doesn't even, you know, it doesn't need to be two or three. It can be a 12-pack. You know, I was only going to drink a 12-pack. But I blew it. You know, I waved at the 12, you know, as I went by, right? Or how many times did I have an agreement with somebody and please don't drink. My mom and dad's 25th anniversary. Please don't drink. Well, Nebraska was playing Oklahoma that day, 1979. You don't ask me to do that. That's ridiculous. Let me tell you what that looked like. That, by 1979, I'd already been I actually tried to get to Greece. In fact, I was like an A. dodo bird sitting there going, yeah, I relate to that. Yeah, yeah, me too, me too, me too. There was something about grade probation and disciplinary probation that I was on that the school had a difficult time in trusting that I'd be okay over there in Greece. So they said no. And I did what every good, you know, self-centered American boy does. I took my bat and ball and went home. And I went through a series of jobs. I went through 10 jobs from May of 1979 to January of 80 when I got here. When I got here, I was working 6 hours a week in a swimming pool, lifeguarding. Okay? And I didn't make it all the time to those 6 hours, my commitment. You know, I mean, that was just like, I know there's 168 hours in the week or something, but sometimes I just got busy. And, so I just couldn't make it. So in November of 1979, I went over to my friend Steve's house. The coolest setup. So if you're going to go out, this is great information, so just write this down. IV bags. It was awesome. IV bags, just booze. Like, you didn't even have to get out of your chair. Booze, just straight. The only time you had to turn it off was to do the bong hit. And then back, just, we're watching Nebraska lose again to Oklahoma. And I went to the 25th party, and it seemed, I don't know if this ever happened to you, but, you know, like, I understood that there was going to be an anniversary party, and I understood that my attendance was important. But once the game got going and the drink got going, you know, just wasn't in, you know, wasn't on the radar anymore. Just sort of fell off the radar. So when I got home, oh yeah, right? So I took a shower, cold shower, and we went down and we ate at this very nice restaurant, and I ended up passing out in my food, and I remember being ushered out by my brother just saying, how could you do this? How do you drink like that? You know, and that's the way it was for me. You know, they found me in my room, doors open, wide open. I hadn't showed up for work again, and I was passed out on the floor, and there was just alcohol and stuff all over. And you know, they reminded me that just over Thanksgiving, you know, just, Mark, I thought you were dead. I can't even believe that you are what you are, you know, in terms of where you're at today. I remember going that Christmas, we're backing into Christmas right now, and getting pots and pans and different things for my apartment for for Christmas presents, and feeling this sense of separation between me and these people that I'm related to. This sense that you're never going to get it, are you? I mean, I'm never going to be one of you, am I? And it was overwhelming. And I went home, and my roommate just happened to have a gun. And I remember thinking about, boy, this would be so nice and so easy just to be done. This life is hard. Just hard. It's not supposed to be. They never told me it was going to be this hard. Yeah, you know, obviously if it worked, you'd have another speaker tonight. But, something happened. Divine providence, grace of God. January 8th, 1980, I was going out to drink again with my friend Steve. Unbeknownst to me, Steve, the guy that we had the party with the IVs and the whole nine yards, he had the cool parents where we could actually smoke dope in the house. And they didn't think it was so cool anymore after a while. Well, I didn't know, and Steve didn't know, that they actually knew somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous that was sober a few years. And what happened is that they invited this guy over to tell Steve his story. Pretty cool deal. That guy told his story to Steve, and Steve related to him. And they said, great, you know, you got an option. One option is to go to treatment. The other option is, if you don't go to treatment, get out of the house. Steve said, I'll go to treatment. And they said, super, the bed will be ready for you tomorrow. Go have a good time. Okay, January 8th, 1980. I get in that car. I don't know that. And we're drinking gin and tonics, listening to the Wingnuts, which was a popular group in Omaha, Nebraska at that time, sitting on the pool table. And Steve tells me his story. Steve's not even a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he tells me his story. He tells me what Carol read. Incomprehensible demoralization. He talks about the four horsemen. He talks about the he talks about my life in a way that was so profound to me in a drunken stupor that I could not deny it. I heard myself say to him, I mean, dude, we're like, this is weird. You got to read my journal. I mean, I'm exactly like you. You're exactly like me. I gave him my journal. He came over the next morning and I said, what do you think? He said, yeah, crazy. I said, well, I'm screwed. I mean, you're going to a treatment center. What am I going to do? And he said, well, why don't you call the treatment center? Maybe you can get in. You know, let me call my parents and see. And so they got the phone number and I said the magic words to the treatment center, you know, Blue Cross and Blue Shield. And dude, I was in. I had not even told my parents. And I just threw some stuff in a duffel bag, and Steve's parents came by the house. And as they're pulling in, my mom pulls in. It didn't even dawn on me to tell my mom that I was going to treatment. I mean, you know what? Why would I even do that? You know, she's like, no, you're not. And I said, yeah, Mom, I got to go. I got to go. I lasted 36 days, and then I was asked to go to a halfway house, and I lasted about 2 weeks. Something about rules, like get a job, get your ass out of bed by 8. You know, different things that were so foreign to me, it was ridiculous. And so, I was the focal point, and we used to have these group meetings about Mark. And so Mark was asked to leave. So I called my mom and dad and told them I was leaving and that I was coming home. And my mom's like, might be just, well, she's no longer around, but I'm probably the most codependent person on the planet. And she said something that was profound to me. No, you can't come home. You can't come home. So if any of you have kids, and I have kids, you know, the answer is no. It's a really hard word to say, no. And I ended up going living with my brother for a few days, and I was talking to a guy that I went to school with at St. John's, and he lived in South Bend, Indiana, and it sounded like a pretty good deal. Now that I had, you know, almost 50 days under my belt, I knew, you know, I could probably deal drugs now and not have to use them all. And everybody knows there's a lot of money in South Bend, Indiana, and I was just, you know, racking in the thousands in my mind. And the phone rings. And it's my counselor from the treatment center, Big John. And John says, what are you doing? And I didn't want to share my big idea, lest he go and beat me there. So I just said, they're hanging out. I'm just hanging out. And he said, well, I set up a meeting for you at the halfway house. Why don't you go back? Well, why would I go back? Well, Mark, you're 20 years old and you never finished anything in your life. Why don't you go back? One of the graces that I've been gifted is this ability. And Terry calls it, he says, I have great range. I'm the most profane person I know, and I'm one of the most spiritual guys he knows, you know. I don't know what that means. Other than, you know, I find myself sometimes in the jams, and it's easy to get me out. Just prayer, just something I hear, a song, something just turns me like that. God's grace, just that fast. Something in a meeting, something that just gets me out of the hum of my own existence enough to reach out, to get out of myself. And that happened. I went and finished there, and I basically have been drag kicking and screaming to AA ever since. And I've been sober since I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've had an amazing life. I've done everything you can do wrong. I've done wrong in AA, and I essentially what I've done for over 10,000 days is not put alcohol in my system. And I just want to talk a little bit about balance, and I want to talk about some of the things that go on in my life and what my life looks like today. And I got married in AA, met a girl in AA, and it was the product of that is two incredible kids. We were married for 15 years, and we're still wonderful friends. And our oldest, Caitlin, is 21, and she is just an amazing girl. And she's going to graduate with honors in elementary education at ASU. And then I have a son, 17, and Adam is Mark. I mean, it's just like that. I don't know if you have any kids that you know, you look at them and you see you. And so I spend a lot of time saying, Adam. I realize, okay, I'm still working on Mark here, so just, you know, bear with me when I confront you about this thing or what I'm just trying to, you know, in terms of separating the two. And Adam is, he's a hard guy to pin down. I think he might be one of us, but he doesn't really have a history. I mean, he gets started. He just goes from a zero to 150 over a period of like a week and a half, and then he gets expelled, and then he doesn't drink for like 8 months. I took him with myself and my dad up to Glacier National Park up in Montana in August. We had an amazing weekend, just a shape-shifting experience for that man. And I watched my son change in front of my eyes. And you know, if any of you have teenagers, you know, I mean, they don't smile for like over a year, well over a year kind of thing. They just look at you like, bring it, right? And so I I'm looking for the switch in the back of his head just to turn him back on. Where's my boy? And the switch just went off on one of the hikes. It was an amazing experience. And then I didn't see him for 2 weeks. I get a call from the school. My son OD'd. And they are eating somas and OxyContin like M&Ms out there on the street. I mean, they drink like, you know, my son drank with impunity. I mean, when he got suspended, he had drank like 10 ounces of vodka and a beer in about an hour, and he went to school, and it was cool. It was like no big deal. And so he happened to eat 8 somas because, you know, 1 and 2 was okay. 4 wasn't too bad. 6 was a nice little buzz, you know. And so 8 was, well, got him to where he wanted to go, I guess. And I'm just so grateful. I'm so grateful that, a part-time bus driver saw him walking funny in the parking lot. And he passed out. And if you know anything about Arizona, sometimes it gets hot over there in August. And it was about $1.10 that day. And my son was walking towards his car. And my son could have passed out in his car. And people die in cars all the time in Arizona. And he could have gotten that car. And those cars are like weapons, you know. And I watched my son, Marty and I beat him to the emergency room. And I watched him unconscious fighting adults. It took, they put straps down him to get him down, and that wasn't enough. They took a netting. It took 8 adults to hold my 130-pound boy down. Just totally ripped my heart out. He's got over 100 days of sobriety now. He doesn't really think he's got a problem, but he's got over 100 days of sobriety, and I'm just totally grateful. And Marty and I were married just 3.5 years ago, and I'm in a relationship with a woman that loves me no matter what. And I have, you know, the exact nature of my wrongs is I'm not enough. So I'm in constant conflict about, you know. And it's an amazing thing. The other thing I want to tell you is that, you know, I fell into a business 6 years ago up in Utah. And I have an opportunity to go back and forth to Utah and try to start a community, of a circle of men up there that are about accountability and integrity. I work in the trenches with guys, you know, and these men changed my life. These men, the privilege I have of men that share their hearts and souls with me. If you're not sponsoring people, you're missing out. You're flat out missing out. A lot of stuff has kept me sober in 28 years, 27 and change. far and away, working with other people, has kept me sober, has kept me on the straight and narrow, has woke me up like, you know, pay attention. Because these guys share stuff. I do the same stuff Nat does. When somebody wants to go through the steps, I go through the steps with those people. So I make that list on page 44. I open the book and I make that list. I dig out of my memory what it was like for me 28 years ago when I was drinking. I try to keep the memory green, and I do that by working with new guys and guys that have been around. Okay? That's what I do. You know, I might have I have an amazing third step experience that happened to me at year 12, and it was an amazing experience. But, you know, that's like trying to stay alive on the water I drank a month ago. You know what I'm saying? Or the air I drank, or air I breathed a week ago. I got to do this deal. I got to stay current in this deal. That's my program. You know, that's my life. The other thing I want to tell you is that I'm going to tell you two things. One is whether you got, doesn't matter how many days you have. One of the things that happened to me is that I started believing my own bullshit. And I started getting further and further away. And I started, you know, the fact that I had some days under my belt, I started thinking I didn't really need direction. And like I forgot that there's a higher power. Okay? And I was gifted a prayer. And I'm going to share it with you. It's called the set-aside prayer. Maybe some of you know it. Maybe some of you are using it. If you aren't, give it a shot. Sometimes I'd sit in meetings and it's the same old, you know, same old Joe speaking about the same old thing on the third step. You know, I already know your story, Joe, you know, and there's Mary and then it's like chatter, 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 chatter. Or, you know, I mean, if you're around here, hopefully you're reading the book and stuff, and some of this stuff might look familiar to you, you know. And so what I try to do is I try to see it in a new eye. And so what the prayer looks like is, Father God, help me set aside everything I think I know about, fill in the blank. Okay? If I'm struggling in my marriage, everything I think I know about Marty. If I'm struggling in the meeting, everything I think I know about this circle, about this topic, about myself, about you, God, about Alcoholics Anonymous. Help me to be open to a new experience of you, of me, Marty, of this circle, of this step. Okay. I grew up Catholic, and then I ended up returning to that religion later on. And one of the things I think that there's a lot of things that are profound in this big book, but one of the things I think is incredibly profound to me is in Bill's story. Bill does not say that we're against God or that we, you know, like we reject God. What he says is a God that's personal to me, a God that's personal to me is, you know, it's just something we can't fathom. And I understand that. I have a belief system that I'm supposed to act a certain way to get points. Maybe it's from all the nuns, you know, from the years of that, or like marching in a certain, you know, looking a certain way. And I knew very early on that the people that think like I think and do the stuff that I do, you know, just aren't going to make it up there, right? Just aren't going to make it up there. And so a friend, I sit in different circles. I go to A meetings, and I have a faith sharing group that I sit in, and the accountability integrity group. And I'm in my faith sharing group, and I had a man look me in the eye, and he said, "You act like you know it all." And it just like pierced my armor. I mean, I heard it, flat out heard it. And he said, you know, in Scripture it says, "See, I make all things new. See, I make all things new." And that's my God. You know, I think about us as I look around here. I think about the half a dozen people that said, "Yeah, I'm new." And probably, I mean, if statistics are right, maybe another half a dozen or so that didn't identify that are sitting in here that are new and for whatever reason can't identify. What I'm telling you is that this group, this circle, can handle anything you can bring. Bring it. Bring all of you to this circle. It can handle it. This program can handle anything you can throw down. I've heard probably 125th steps. I've probably done about 80 or 90. I've never, you know, bring it. Bring it. Get free. Get free. You know, this is the place that we get free. This is the place that we get back into the mainstream. We talk about getting, you know, what can we pack into this life? What can we pack into our life? How are we doing? This thing isn't working. Okay, thank you. So, I'm going to tell a nine-step story. And it's along the line of, see, I make all things new. Actually, it starts out as a four-step story. I was about 16 years sober, and I'm writing a four-step, and my 10-year-old daughter showed up on it. And, you know, 10-year-old daughters aren't supposed to be on resentment lists. So just in case you're new, you don't know that. Okay. Need a little time to figure that out. The reason they're not supposed to be on that list is because they're going to out you. Okay. They're going to out you. I'm in a place or a space that I trust spirit. I trust what comes. When I do a list, I get quiet and I write what comes for me. I may not understand why it's there. I trust what's come for me. And so I write, why do I resent my daughter? I resent her because, you know what? I'm a traveling salesman, and when I call, she don't come running to the phone. She doesn't seem all that excited to hear from Daddy. You know? Daddy's little girl doesn't seem so enamored with Daddy right now. Right? And there was a few other little things. What's that impacting? Well, it's impacting my personal relations. It's impacting my ambition. Wasn't into my pocketbook. It wasn't into sex relations. What? At any rate, and then I went over to this side and I started to look at this. What was her part in it? What was my part in this? What was it in the fourth column? And I saw that some of the things that I was doing in terms of, you know, what was up for me is fear and self-centered fear and self-centeredness. And where it revolved around is I wanted her to pay attention to me. And as I went deeper with that, I saw that my daughter was doing the behavior that I modeled to her. Okay? She was mimicking her dad. The dad who was too busy behind the sports section or the laptop or, you know, solving the problems of the world or, you know, this sponsee needs me right now or, you know, later, 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 later. Okay? And as I dug deeper to that, I saw that, you know, I grew up with a dad that, you know, for whatever reason, was modeled to him that women were not peers, you know, in his generation. It's just what was modeled to him. And I picked up on that. He never said anything to me, but I just got that. I got that in my head, and I realized that I was treating my daughter like that, like it was okay, because she's my daughter, right? And so I realized what that amend looked like. And I sat down with my 10-year-old on my A-step list, and looked her in the eye and told her my truth and told her what I was feeling. And I told her about men and women. And I told her about how it was for me to be raised and the impact and how I was awoke to the fact that I didn't see her as an equal. And that was nothing about her. It was something about me. So I wanted her to wake up to what was going on, that she deserved to be treated with respect. As a child of God, she didn't need to kneel before anybody. She deserved to be honored, loved, and affirmed just for who she was, period. I never was told that. I never was told that. I got to tell my daughter that. I have an amazing relationship with my daughter today as a result of that amends. If I had to shine that off, you know, I'd have missed the whole deal. So, in closing, trust the process. You know, read the black. Just do what it says. Trust the process. Get hooked up. Sponsor other people. It'll be the greatest thing on the planet in terms of them getting to see you and you getting to see them. Thank you for your time.